Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Maggs with 30 minutes packed with the latest South African and global news. We are live and then you can catch us later as a podcast. Stay tuned for interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, delivering all the essential updates that you need fast and focused. It's Monday, the 23rd of September, and on the program today, 2 weeks of the two-pot retirement system and a dire warning is sounded about withdrawals. South African Breweries takes on government about high beer excise duty, why IQ alone does not determine your success, and why South Africa is not embracing Elon Musk's Starlink satellite system. The Momentum Group says it's received something in the region of 112,000 two-pot withdrawal applications to a cumulative value of around 1.7 billion rand. The group says it's paid 81% of all withdrawal applications, and this percentage is climbing both daily and steadily. Dumo Mbete is the Chief Executive Officer of Momentum Corporate and joins us now. And Dumo, first of all, what are the main reasons that individuals close to retirement are withdrawing funds, and what concerns do you think this raises for their future financial security?
Jeremy, when I look at our overall picture, in the first week or so, we had about 40% of applications for withdrawal coming from members between the ages of 40 and 49. And as the days went by, we also saw a significant increase in the age band of 30 to 39. Now, you tend to find in these sort of age groups, you know, yes, it's economically active individuals who in all likelihood also have children who are at school, you know, so their family responsibilities and the like. And that's also where you're likely to find your most significant levels of immediate financial pressure. So we do believe that given the financial commitments that individuals in those age brackets have and the level of financial strain, you would then tend to see more withdrawals in those age bands. Now, the counter, though, to that is, I mean, if you're closing in on 49, that's pretty much leaving most people in South Africa with about 11 years to retirement. And if the individuals in these age groups continue to withdraw the one-third every year until they retire, we will see, you know, significant shortfalls in their ability to retire comfortably. That's really the risk that we are worried about.
Also of concern is that 30 to 39 age band, because it also says to me that they're not laying a foundation.
Yes. You know, the ability to have a comfortable retirement is influenced by saving at high enough levels and doing so for long enough. And you're right, these sort of withdrawals will start to chip away at that ability, you know, to gain the benefits from compound interest and growing value for a longer period of time. So it does shake the foundation. We appreciate that, you know, where there are genuine emergencies, you know, it also enables members in those age groups to address pressing issues, pressing financial issues in their lives. And fortunately, as we go forward, we do have the two-thirds preservation rule that also that comes through. So we should see an accumulation of that two-thirds compulsory preservation as they go towards retirement. So at least if someone is at the age of 30, perhaps the impact is minimized, but I'd say if you're closer to 39, then we start going into troubled territory there.
Let's move away from the age bands and look at income, and 60% of applicants coming from low-income groups who are wanting to make some kind of withdrawal. That is not surprising.
No, it's not surprising at all. I think as much as the messages across the industry have been about the importance of preservation, looking at all three pots as part of your retirement savings and therefore only accessing in the event of emergencies, we are in a nation where people are under significant financial strain. I mean, interest rates are at the highest levels they've been, in 15 years. So that just gives you a sense of the pressure, individuals are facing in South Africa. So yes, disposable income is under pressure. People are, dealing in most cases with genuine emergencies. But then I think now there's also an element of people simply wanting to take the money because it's available, it's there. And then also, Jeremy, here, what we've seen is the tidal wave, from the 2nd of September. And I think this probably is also influenced, from a behavioral science perspective. If you tell people that from date X, you can withdraw an amount, let's say up to 30,000 in this first year of implementation, but you can only do that once a year. And in that once per tax year, people are basically looking at that and saying, shucks, if I only have one shot at this per tax year, I will simply take the whole amount. So actually, people are not part withdrawing. So if I have potential access to 20, I don't take 10 because I need 10. I simply take the 20 because the 20 is available.
Having said that, though, your survey or your research also indicates increased engagement with financial advisors. Surely that's a good thing?
Yes. Yes. No, that's definitely a good thing. In fact, the two-pot system has been a topic, especially over the last month or so, which has been on the lips of many in South Africa. And as a retirement funds industry, we've never had this level of conversation and engagement on social media and all platforms around retirement benefits. So there's definitely a lot more awareness. So people are coming in, checking their balances, updating contact details, and also updating beneficiary nominations, which has always been a challenge for the industry. We've also seen people taking up digital solutions. So this is also shifting the industry nicely into the digital age. And in our space, we've seen more than 80% of claims coming via digital channels. Now, on the back of this, we have also been encouraging individuals and members to look into financial advice before they press that button on their cell phone or as they walk into some of our offices across the country. And that has been a plus. So people are speaking to financial advisors, they are speaking to retirement benefit counselors. And we've seen, yes, that the instances are few and far between, but instances where individuals say, actually, thank you very much. I will hold back on withdrawing at this point. Or in some cases, they take up additional products that are relevant to their financial needs. So that level of awareness, is something that we see perhaps as a silver lining on the cloud.
Just very quickly and in conclusion, do you think this is going to taper off, or do you think that it'll continue with the same degree of acceleration that you've seen?
Well, yeah, so let's look at the first 2 weeks. More than 112,000 applications received across the Momentum Group to the value of 1.7 billion rand. Now, we see that almost as like a first wave. In this week, as an example, we have seen a slight tapering, but definitely not to a point where we can say the tide has completely pulled back. And also, if you look at the number of claims, it's probably what we would typically process in 5 months. We've had to kind of deal with in 2 weeks. So the volumes are not abating. And here, Jeremy, I basically predict a number of waves. The second wave is likely to be around December, as people are now gearing up for, the holidays and all of that, and any commitments related to the holidays. We are likely to see another wave in January in relation to school fees and the like. And then perhaps the last one in February, because the withdrawal, you're only allowed one withdrawal per tax year. So in February, you're likely then to see another influx of people trying to make use of the one withdrawal per year opportunity. Now, where this is going to become even more interesting, and we will be observing the human behavior around this, is in February 2026 and February 27, etc., because now that will be the last month of the tax year, and people who have been accumulating the one third during that tax year might then look to withdraw. We would hope that people don't do that because the legislation itself and this solution was really put in place for genuine financial emergencies. But, indeed, where they are there, and given the fact that there's only one opportunity within a tax year to withdraw, we expect that is the likely behavior
Right.
pattern that we will see.
I'm going to leave it there with thanks, Dumo Mbete, Chief Executive Officer, Momentum Corporate. I do appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, beer giant SAB says government is disproportionately reliant on the beer-making industry for excise duties, which accounts for around 35% of total excise revenues in the 23-24 financial year. Over the past couple of years, the company has made repeated appeals to government to reconsider its approach to beer taxation policies. Professor Keith Engel is with us now. He's the Chief Executive Officer of the South African Institute for Taxation. And Keith, firstly then, what are the primary factors, in your opinion, that is driving government's heavy reliance on the industry?
Well, I think the issue on these beer taxes or alcohol or whatever those are, the sin taxes, it always starts with a moral issue. And the issue of, well, we're going to tax you for sin to discourage it, right? So we want you to drink less, and that's the goal. But what you find is that taxes on beer and alcohol or other forms of government things are typically ineffective. They don't really reach the desired result. Then they quickly become an issue about revenue. And if you look at alcohol, like gambling or other things, they tend to have very high profit margins. And so government starts sharing in the profit and they sort of share in the gain. And that's just the way it typically falls out. And when you look at all these reports, you'll see that there's so many factors in this tax that really, at the end of the day, it's an easy way to raise revenue. Because when you raise taxes on beer or cigarettes, publicly, nobody can condemn you for that. Whereas if you raise income tax, it's a problem. So government becomes a partner in the revenue raising, and that's where they're ultimately at now.
But it's all about finding a balance, Keith, between revenue generation on the one hand, but also maintaining industry viability, surely.
Absolutely. Well, that's where you come to, because at the beginning, you're pretending that you're trying to stop the activity, but really what you're trying to do is maybe lessen it a little bit, but what you want to do is keep your revenue going. So if you remember during COVID, when we shut down the industry, and we especially on cigarettes, all of a sudden, the revenue service was screaming. So what you're seeing now when it comes to this tax is the same old thing as the Laffer curve, just in a different form. So when it comes to income tax, once you start getting too high in the percentages, it becomes an issue of declining revenue. Now the same thing starts popping up with alcohol. And so you've got to be careful how much money you're taking from the industry. At this point, the government is taking a higher share of the revenue than the actual companies themselves. Now, at what point do you keep raising that tax and then you start losing revenue? And I think we're sort of at that level. And the second issue that becomes for the industry is there are ways in which you raise the tax. So if you raise it, you can raise the tax, but you have to do it in a way that is efficient for industry. So one of the problems is we have a very old-fashioned way of raising the tax. The minister will stand up and announce on his budget speech, the tax is going up tomorrow in 24 hours. That's very disruptive for industry. And it costs a lot of money for industry, and they can't pass it along to the consumer. And so the industry gets damaged when they do things in a rushed fashion. And what the industry is saying is, do what you're going to do, but please give us some advance notice.
So, Keith, if we're at something of an inflection or a nexus point here and the trajectory continues, what is the impact going to be on the broader liquor industry, do you think?
Well, what happens is if you start taxing it too much, they start happening is what happens with cigarettes. People shift to other sources. So if they're committed to what they're committed to, and I think people are committed to social drinking and that kind of thing, what you'll see is people will go have their own distilleries, and you'll see in a lot of areas they do that, or they will go to other alternatives that will be there, or they'll try to get around the tax illegally. And so what you do find is that there's a growth in the illegal industry. Now, it's not as bad in the alcohol industry as it is for the cigarette industry, but once it catches hold, it becomes easier and easier for people. So what happens is the formal industry loses out and government loses out and the drinking continues. So they have to be very careful.
So you talked about a better way of doing this. What would that better way be?
Well, I think one was a simple procedure request. So what the industry is asking is, one, if you're going to make the announcement, give us at least 30 days so that we can change our pricing. And so make it go into effect 1 April. The other one that they're looking for is, if you're going to change pricing, let us know over a period. Don't announce it, you know, day one and change it. Say, this is the 3-year trajectory that we want. And base it on a 3-year trajectory. And then let people know that when the minister announces, this is what's going to go for the 3 years. That's the second request. And the third request they're having is, take into account inflation. Because when people buy alcohol or anything, they don't see the excise tax and the VAT as something separate. They see it as all in one. So when you're pricing it, you have to price an all-inclusive price, not a separate price. And those are the three requests they're making. That would be a good start that everybody would win.
And Keith, in terms of the way in which the numbers stack up and the implication, the report indicates a 1% increase in beer prices above inflation leads to a 0.9% drop in demand. So fairly equitable there, but there are broader economic implications of such a decline, particularly in terms of job losses and reduced economic activity. So you've got to be worried about the domino effect.
Well, that's right. And see, this is what's happening, because now government is depending on this revenue source. And we also want to get economic growth. So at some point, the tax hurts. So we saw this very clear when it came to the sugar industry, right? We went after beverages and we damaged our sugar industry. So do you really want to damage your own industries? And I would think that government needs to keep the growth factor in mind. And they don't like hearing that. But again, if you start taxing things too much, you are going to hurt the formal industry. So that's really what they're saying at that point, and are you at that inflection point? And our alcohol taxes are relatively high in this country. And so the problem is, government says they want to raise the tax because it's easy, but at some point it becomes less easy and it becomes damaging. And I think we've reached that point.
So I would be interested to know then how the current excise tax regime on beer in this country compares with international benchmarks. You said that we are taxed relatively high in comparison. So are there lessons then that we could learn from other countries' approaches to taxing the beer industry?
Yeah, well, I guess the key would be, I think there can be. I think the problem is that government is not clear in what it wants to achieve. And so government starts out with one purpose, but quietly another purpose comes in there. And so the original purpose was, we want to tax sin and we're trying to discourage it. But taxes on alcohol and cigarettes, is, other than a signaling effect, really doesn't do much. So the real thing it's becoming now, it's really about raising revenue and not damaging growth. And I think they need to be honest about what they're trying to achieve, and then you can start drawing lessons. Then the question is, which lessons and which economy? The problem is, we're probably more akin to an African economy when it comes to beer than Europe. And so the difficulty is, there's not enough data on those points. So that makes it difficult. But I do think it is worth having that international comparison to see what works and what doesn't. One of the issues is that other countries do take into account inflation when they're setting prices. And that, I think that's an important thing. And you don't want to damage your industry on that side. But I think there's the limit on that and what can be achieved.
I am going to leave it there with my sincere appreciation, Professor Keith Engel, Chief Executive Officer, the SA Institute for Taxation. I do appreciate the clarity. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, you'll be well aware there's been a lot of talk recently around SpaceX's uncapped satellite internet service Starlink, which, writes the My Broadband platform, could be of huge benefit for many South African households and businesses, particularly in rural areas, and not necessarily an expensive internet solution compared to competing services. So let's work through the pros and cons with Hanno Labuschagne, who writes for My Broadband. And Hanno, first of all then, how do you see Starlink addressing connectivity challenges faced by rural households and businesses specifically?
Yeah, it's an interesting topic. A lot of people often point out that Starlink is quite expensive, especially when you look at the subscription prices in countries like the US. Because it's an international service, it's a little bit different from what you would find within the country's borders alone. But if you look at the bigger picture of what it's charging in other African countries, the price is about somewhere within the region of around 700 Rand to 1,000 Rand when converted to RAN now. And that might sound like a lot for poor communities in rural areas, but it's useful to bear in mind that many of these communities have barely any internet access as it is. Some of them have only satellite connectivity, and that is the older forms of satellite is very, very expensive. Some of it can perform fairly well, but the speeds are nowhere near what Starlink can achieve. And Starlink just has so much more bandwidth. And I think that is the key. Starlink has the potential to be shared by multiple users in communal areas like libraries and schools. It's got much greater potential than current or older satellite technologies. And I think that is where the potential really lies. Mm.
So that argument that some have put forward about existing broadband options are sufficient is blown out the water as far as you're concerned.
So South Africa is certainly ahead of the curve slightly compared to the rest of the continent. We do have a well-established telecoms ecosystem, and we've got a lot of options. But the truth is that many of those options are very concentrated in areas that are more affluent, in the leafy suburbs. You know, we've got fiber that is rolled out at rapid pace. And then we've also got fixed wireless access. We've got solutions like fixed LTE and fixed 5G. So there's plenty of broadband options within the cities. And that's never been Starlink's target to compete with those technologies. Starlink's target's always been to bring connectivity to other parts, to rural parts of the world or areas that where conventional broadband technologies are difficult, you know, like out at the sea or up in the air in an airplane. I think we many of us would have experienced the terrible experience that is airplane Wi-Fi, you know. So it aims to address those gaps. And I think in regards to that, it really isn't fair to say that, you know, we've got sufficient connectivity. Go and talk to farmers or businessmen in rural areas. Go talk to safari lodges. Go talk to mining companies, and they will tell you that it is a challenge to stay connected from these areas. And many of these sectors are evolving where internet connectivity becomes more important. You know, in agriculture, you need to be at the cutting edge these days to keep ahead with the trends and what can make your farm thrive. So, no, certainly I don't think it's fair to say that. We are in the position that we have a much more mature telecoms environment than some other African countries, and we've already got lots of employment in the sector. And of course, yes, there is a threat that Starlink poses just because it's so good that it actually does threaten some jobs, specifically in the fixed wireless access department where you've got these Wi-Fi service providers. But there's many arguments to be made about, you know, the technology simply isn't there yet to provide good, affordable bandwidth or broadband using those technologies. And the best answer is Starlink. And Starlink might have, you know, other benefits down the line, economic benefits, especially in terms of business growth and then eventually jobs growth for the customers it serves.
So how are the current players, I'm thinking of the Cell C's and the Vodacoms and the MTNs, responding to this?
We've had very little official word in terms of their views of Starlink's attempts or non-attempts to get regulatory approval in South Africa. It's a little bit of a grey area at the moment. This is, apparently there are high-level discussions underway, but it's a little bit hush-hush. ICASA says that they have not received a formal application, but we've had some sources say that, yes, there are important people from Starlink talking to other important people in South Africa that have some sway in this about getting approval locally. But on the area, in the area of direct to cell, Vodacom and MTN see a lot of potential. So there's two types of Starlink connectivity. There's fixed connectivity, for which you need like this dish or a kit which you can use at home. And then there's their mobile connectivity, which is still very new. They've only got a few satellites up in there, a few dozen satellites that support direct to cell capability. And this is actually groundbreaking technology. This will allow you to, on a normal 4G or 5G phone, get internet while roaming on Starlink. You don't need a special dish or anything strange. And fortunately, what Starlink is doing, I think fortunately for the terrestrial carriers like Vodacom and MTN and Cell C and these guys, is it wants to sell this product to them as a sort of roaming a package that if they've got a partnership with Starlink, they can have their customers roam on Starlink when they are in areas that there are no towers available, because this technology is fairly new, so it's not that fast yet. Starlink is starting out with just basic texting, and then they'll move on to voice calls and data. But yeah, that's actually the groundbreaking technology. And MTN and Vodacom have confirmed they are in discussions with, MTN has confirmed they are in discussions with Starlink and a bunch of other low Earth orbit satellite operators. That is the new technology that Starlink is using that is much faster and has greater bandwidth. It's just a bit ahead of the rest of the pack in terms of sending satellites into the air, because it benefits from SpaceX, its parent company, of course.
The end goal for everybody is better connectivity. What sort of timeline, Hanno, do we have on all of this?
So, our sources have said that within the next few weeks, we'll know more about Starlink's approval path in South Africa and whether we'll see official approval. There are already people unofficially using the service, which ICASA regards to be illegal, it's got a roaming aspect to its normal service as well. So if you've got a kit registered in another country, you can use it in South Africa if you've got a roaming subscription and use that kit in other countries. So there's definitely demand for it. We see a lot of people that are just risking, using this illegal connectivity just because it's so much better. So hopefully in the next few weeks, we'll have more clarity and official word on this. I do believe the regulatory team from Starlink is now moving at full momentum, and South Africa might be next on the priority map, because if you look at all the other countries in sub-Saharan Africa, they're all getting it. So it might look like a bit of a blight if South Africa is missing. So we'll see that happening within the next few weeks. But the direct to cell, I think, will be only from next year and onwards where we'll start seeing that roaming on Vodacom and MTN using LEO satellite connectivity.
Well, the pace of technology is certainly moving very quickly. Hanno Labuschagne, thank you very much indeed. Writing for My Broadband, thank you so much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
And finally on the program, intelligence quotient, or IQ, has traditionally been considered a key indicator of potential, but it is increasingly no longer the sole indicator of personal and professional success, particularly in South Africa's diverse environment. This is because social quotient, or SQ, and cultural quotient, CQ, are emerging as additional key factors being considered when hiring and promoting candidates. So how does this impact the workplace specifically? I'm in conversation now with Talitha van Wyk, who is head of program at the Independent Institute of Education. And Talitha, how then is all of this playing out?
In terms of IQ, that's always been the quotient that everyone's been focusing on. It's something that people are very familiar with. And not even very recently, I think the attentiveness to these new intelligences are really coming to the forefront quite recently, but it's actually been around, like AQ, for example, from 2010, SQ, for example, from the 1920s already, and CQ from 2003. But I think people's knowledge was more around the IQ until recently.
What exactly does SQ and CQ measure, and why do you think it's becoming so relevant now?
SQ is your social quotient, so it measures an individual's ability to navigate their social environments, build and maintain relationships, and totally understand social norms and dynamics, which is obviously things that I think subconsciously we've been doing and it's just been happening, but the focus is a lot on that with the diverse cultures that we these days work with and the diverse environments, and with companies focus more on diversification and inclusion. And in terms of your cultural quotient, which evaluates an individual's capability to function effectively in culturally diverse settings, you know, really understanding and adapting to different cultural norms and practices, it's really just been making people more aware of it, and especially in leadership within companies, to be able to incorporate all of these cultures to be more inclusive and diverse in the workplace as well.
Talita, you put forward a very good argument, but how would you respond to criticism that maybe IQ does still remain the most reliable predictor of professional success in spite of the rise of these other two quotients?
I would definitely say that IQ is probably still your main quotient, and all these others like AQ, your adaptability quotient, EQ, your emotional intelligence, all of these really feed into your IQ. I truly believe that when we look and focus on all these various quotients and intelligences that are out there and that people are becoming more aware of, that it can actually increase your IQ as well. Because as we know, IQ can be improved as well as the rest of these intelligences. It's not something that this is how I'm doing it, or this is my SQ, or this is my AQ, and it can't be improved. It's definitely something that can be developed over time and can absolutely improve your IQ at the end of the day.
So are there then specific strategies that a company can use to measure SQ and CQ effectively, given what I assume is the subjective nature of both of those dynamics?
For sure. I think there are various things that companies currently do and subconsciously incorporate in things like your key performance indicators when they look at the employees, because all of these intelligences are actually so interconnected. So if they look at the employees and they look at the social skills, the relationships that they have with one another and how they work together in the diverse environment that they are in, you know, how are they actually coping with different cultures? Are they able to communicate but listen effectively? Are they able to adapt in terms of their communication styles, their behavior within different cultures and within the social setup that they are working in? So there are quite a variety of things that employers can look at, even within interviews, you know, by looking at how they interact within the interview. Have they done their homework about the culture of the company that they are being interviewed for? So there's quite a few things. There are assessments out there specifically on the various intelligences that people can do, but quite a few ways that it can be measured in the workplace.
So how difficult then is it for employees who might have a naturally high IQ but lower SQ and CQ to start developing those skills? Can they be taught?
Absolutely. And this is the great thing about these intelligences. It can be improved. It can be developed over time. And I think the main thing is for us to find and to really try and balance and develop all these different kinds of combinations, because it comes down to our self-awareness, our practical experience, the continuous learning that we do in the workplace. But if I can quickly just focus on social cohesion, for example, one way of developing it is really to expand our networks, to attend networking events, join professional groups, engage in different community activities where we can build and maintain different connections. actions. An example to improve our cultural cohesion, for example, is to develop cultural adaptability, to adapt our behavior, our communication style to fit into different cultural contexts. So in other words, to be flexible and open to adjusting our approach in different environments that we find ourselves in. But there are quite a few other ways to improve and develop these questions as well. Those are just two examples.
Do you foresee a future where SQ and CQ outweigh IQ?
In my personal opinion, I wouldn't say it would outweigh it. I think it will be really looking at the balance of the different intelligences and how that leads into IQ at the end of the day. So because they all feed into IQ, I don't think they will overtake it, but I think it's finding that balance and looking in our employees, where are basically at the end of the day the strengths and weaknesses in terms of these different intelligences, and how can we help our employees grow that can feed into that IQ and improve that.
So Talita, you've been talking to me for about 5 or 6 minutes now. How would you rate my SQ and CQ?
In the kind of questions, Jeremy, that you've been asking, I would say it's quite high.
That's the right answer.
In terms of SQ.
You're very welcome to come back. Talita, fascinating conversation. Thank you. I'm sure lots of HR practitioners would be listening to that. Talita van Wyk is head of program at the Independent Institute of Education. Appreciate your time. And that's our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.